session number 10923, reel 12.
Mr. Harold Harper, reel 12. You were doing some experimental firing at this time. Do you remember them? There was sound ranging. Do you remember anything about that?
Sound ranging, very little, except that, don't forget, I was at the gun position and therefore not really involved. But from what I remember, this was where you get cross observation, if you like, of sound or from various plotted in observation posts, and thereby getting some idea exactly where the sound was coming from. I say some idea because obviously sound is not the ideal method of plotting the position of an enemy.
Would that be similar? They actually had cross-observation experience.
Cross-observation would be exactly the same as indeed going back to the Tobruk days when we had flash spotting from various observation posts during the night.
Yeah. What about airburst ranging? I appreciate you're at the gun position. Airburst ranging and shooting into position with airbursts are two things mentioned.
There again, airburst ranging. I suppose airburst ranging was used because it was easy to observe the fall of shot. And therefore, if your fall of shot came over an escarpment, you didn't exactly know where it was dropping, whereas with airburst ranging you could observe. And that, to my mind, is the only reason it was used.
What they also said that this is when you began using the stonk. Could you explain what the stonk was?
The stonk was a code word for plastering an area. And we would probably have on the gun positions a registered target. And if they, rather than sort of go into a lot of detail and say, and give you so many rounds gunfire onto such and such a target, the word stonk would come down, and the only reason it was used was because that could come from the brigade headquarters. And it was the brigadier who gave the instruction for stonk. In other words, he probably brought about three regiments all onto line onto one target. And the area was literally plastered by X number of rounds of gunfire. I think it was 10 rounds per gun, something like that, if I remember.
Do you remember any of the other operations before the actual El Alamein barrage?
Oh, yes. Oh, most definitely. Have we mentioned the September attack?
No.
No. This was a most important one because although we were in gun positions at El Alamein, we got moved out and south towards the Qatara Depression because it was found that Rommel was having his last fling to get to Cairo by going, deploying his forces in the south, and where obviously we were at our weakest at the time, and we got moved down there very, very quickly. It was the first time we'd really deployed the whole regiment since we'd had 5-5s. And the exercise, well, it wasn't an exercise really. I think we succeeded in as much as the enemy were driven back, but we did lose one gun detachment in a dive bombing raid, and we also lost a signals crew who were machine gunned from the air. It was, we took a little bit of a hammering, but nevertheless, I think in general, it was a successful, well, it led up to, obviously, up to El Alamein, of course.
When you're under these dive bombing attacks and the machine gun, That was your troop, B troop, that was particularly affected, wasn't it?
This was B troop, yes.
And did it affect morale at all? Because
it always affects morale, very temporary. But by that time during the war, we become so used to it, quite frankly. Always after an air raid, you had a jittery stomach every time you heard a plane, irrespective of whether it was your own or the enemy's. There was plenty to do there. We fired a lot, and consequently, I mean, that takes one's mind off what has happened. But we did lose one or two very good chaps there, only. And I think one of the problems there was on number one gun, which was Albert Swinton's gun, the ammunition truck was hit and set on fire, and it was a little bit hazardous for about three quarters of an hour while that was still sort of exploding.
What happened there? That was September.
That was in September, and after about 4 days or 5 days in that area, I can't really remember the exact time, we returned to our normal Alamein gun positions.
The same positions?
The same positions, exactly. And then we started preparing for the Alamein barrage by moving up to forward positions in the night, not with the guns, incidentally, just on our own, with ammunition trucks, and burying the ammunition in behind the gun pits, sweeping all the sand, or not to give any indication that there was anything going off there at all. And we did that every night from the hours of about 10 o'clock until 2 o'clock the following morning. Biggest job afterwards was to find the shells.
They weren't marked then at all?
Well, we obviously tried to mark them, but it was not easy, quite frankly, to dig them up.
Did you lose any?
I think we must have done. There's no way I can remember getting all mine out of the trenches that we dug. Somebody many years afterwards would find them.
What about a lot of comment is about Montgomery brought in a more comprehensive briefing system. Were you aware of that on the ground?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, this was the first time during the war that we had a commander who literally told us, man for man, exactly what was happening. When I say exactly, I mean, there was no way he sort of said how we were going to deploy the troops or anything like that. I mean, that was obviously for the generals and the brigadiers and what have you. But at least we knew that a campaign was going to be launched. We knew what the objects were. It was all very, very encouraging, quite frankly. And we saw he actually came, you know, on the gun position. This was another important factor, that we actually saw the commander.
What, Montgomery?
Oh, yes. We saw Churchill. He came into one of our gun pits.
What impression did they both make on you?
Oh, tremendous. The Churchill one was absolutely...
Could you tell me about that? What happened? Were you there in the gun pit, I mean?
I was in the... No, it wasn't in my gun pit. It was in the next gun pit to mine, yeah. But we were told to clear the gun pits up because we were expecting a VIP. And I thought my first reaction was, well, how's the brigadier coming again for, you know, or the 30 Corps commander? Lo and behold, we saw this very familiar figure coming out of this car and coming along, and he actually went to the next gun pit to mine. Whilst he was there, there was a little bit of a panic because a Messerschmitt flew over, but it obviously was just doing a bit of reconnoitring, that's all. It didn't drop anything. But was Churchill actually popular?
Oh,
tremendously popular. Tremendously popular. We somehow contrived to listen to his broadcasts. Every man in the regiment could speak like Churchill, you know. Never in the field, you know. You could hear these chaps all sort of imitating him. Yes, tremendous. And Montgomery, too.
Well, do you remember Montgomery's visit at all?
We saw Montgomery on numerous occasions. He would come onto the gun position. Oh, yes. I don't know how he found time, quite frankly. But he did. Oh, yes.
What was he like?
He would talk on the same level as the men. There's no doubt about it. He gained fantastic respect from the men. Certainly the 8th Army were behind him to a man.
Was there any other preparation that had to be done? You've got the forward gun positions.
Yes, the other preparations were we got about 24 hours notice of what the targets were going to be. So we had to sit down, or at least the gun position officer had to sit down with his assistant and work each individual gun program out, starting at 9:40 and going through till about 3 o'clock the following morning.
Would you help in that? I mean, you could.
Yes.
Do it.
Now this is the point I was just coming to. There was so much pressure on these chaps that I went along and did my own gun program, being in the position to help. Unfortunately, the other gun sergeants couldn't do this, but at least it helped them to get the thing done.
Were you rusty at all?
No, never lost any, you know, everything was still there. The gun program took something like 2.5 to 3 hours to prepare.
For your gun?
For one gun. Because we had to cover vast areas. We were sort of moving quite a number of degrees and ranges and goodness knows what else. I think all the targets have been pretty well reconnoitred by the Air Force and the forward observation people. We knew exactly where where Rommel had got his troops massed and what have you. Although I understand, you know, later that the greatest damage we did was one of our areas was to blast a minefield. We weren't aiming at any particular hostile people, but it was to blast the minefield to let the tanks and the infantry through. So that's why a lot of concentration was done on that. Yeah.
So when did you move up to the forward gun position? Would that be the...
On the October the 22nd, the night before.
So that would be the 20th then, because it was 23rd.
No, 23rd was Alamein. Thursday night. We moved up to the forward positions on the 22nd and sat there all day.
Any last minute jobs that had to be done?
We were really literally finalising the programmes at 9 o'clock at night, and we were due to fire them off at 20 to 10.
So what was the barrage like? What happened on
it? It's beyond description, quite frankly, because apparently nothing had ever been seen like it, either before or after. There were something like 923 guns, I think, to be exact, in an area of less than 20 miles. The whole lot started firing on a precise second, and literally the whole sky seemed to, well, the whole world seemed to burst, quite frankly. I don't know what it was like for the Germans on the other end. And this, literally, this incessant fire carried on from, as I say, 20 to 10 until, well, in my case, 2:30, because my gun seized up.
What was it like during one of these things? How did the guns respond to this sort of continuous firing?
Well, the gun and the equipment.
The equipment, yeah.
Oh, well, overheating was one of the problems. We had to have an artificer on hand all the time to fill up with what they call the oil, because we found, for example, on my gun, that by about 12:30, we were having to push the barrel back. The real recoil system was going, so that had to be filled up with what they call buffer oil. And we had to have a temporary halt while the gun cooled down, filled it up with buffer oil, and then started in. And my job was to sort of start on the program at the appropriate time.
So you'd skip bits.
So
of the
we program. had to skip bits of the program if we pulled out of action. Yeah.
You wouldn't go.
And of course, we had to report back to the gun position officer exactly what was happening.
What about for the crew? What was it like? Because the shells were much heavier than the 75
pounds. The crew response, well, I think they were glad to get on with it, quite frankly. I did have one minor problem, which I must report. After we'd fired about 10 or 12 rounds, I suddenly thought, blimey, it's beginning to get hard work. And I noticed one bloke was missing. And he, strangely enough, he was the biggest bloke in the crew. And he was literally hiding in the slit trench behind the gun. So I had to go and drag him out in the middle of the barrage and get him by the scruff of the neck and threaten to shoot him if he didn't get back on the job, so to speak. Because obviously, if you do get that sort of thing in action, it becomes contagious. So I had to do something drastic to get the thing back on the equilibrium.
You threatened to shoot him, but would you have done?
Yes, I think I would, yeah. I know it sounds terrible now, but you're a different sort of animal in those days.
Did he go back? Or
yes, he did. Yeah.
Was he any good when he got back to the...
Yes, eventually he came round and, you know, and but he was never quite the same again afterwards. And I think the first excuse he got, I think he was evacuated for something or other.
Now, your gun seized up, you said.
Oh yes, but at 2:30, yes, mine seized up altogether.
Was that because of this oil, the buffers?
I think what had happened in the past during the Alamein sort of occupation is that my gun had probably fired, well, it had, we know from the records, it had fired very, very more rounds than the remainder. And consequently, the fear was that it was needed calibrating. And after the Alamein barrage, and let's face it, the Alamein barrage finished at something like 4:30 in the morning. We were firing then spasmodically for the next 6 or 7 days, because the battle was not won on the night of the 23rd. It was about a week after before we managed to break through. In fact, at one time there was this question as to whether we would break through. But eventually we did. And we were firing quite considerably for about 7 days. I know one night we did what we call harassing fire because there was, we knew there were German troops out on the headland, and we were firing one round every 2 minutes right throughout the night. And my gun was selected to do that because we took it in turns, and I found that because two other guns were out of action on that particular night, we had to double up. I'll tell you another amusing story here, you see. Because we were only firing one round every 3 minutes, I think it was to be, not 2 minutes, every 3 minutes, one round. It was to keep the Germans awake, really, and not quite knowing what was going to happen next. Because we were doing this, I said to my detachment, "You've not had a sleep for about 4 nights. Go and get yourselves away from the gun. Get yourselves down. And my land sergeant and myself, well, we can manage this between us." One round every 3 minutes, it was chicken feed. We no sooner started this than we got a report that another gun that was going to sort of fire spasmodically with us was out of action. So the message I got from the GPO, which was Lieutenant Foles, was, "You'll have to double up." So I reported back to the GPO and told him my situation, and the next thing was the GPO came on the gun and the three of us managed to fire these rounds between us. So we got the gun position officer firing with us, which was the fact that he had previously been a sergeant in Tobruk. I mean, that helped anyway. Yeah.
But you say the gun seized up during the first night.
The first night, yeah.
What was that caused by that?
That was lack of, well, there was a leak of buffer oil.
How long would that take to fix?
About 3/4 of an hour. Yeah.
So then you'd resume
then
firing?
Then resume firing, yeah.
Did lack of sleep, did it cause any problems
to
you?
In those days, no. We got used to it. Yeah, we were about 5 days, never took our boots off or anything. I can remember one very amusing incident on this, on one night when we were at Alamein, when my lair, who was a land sergeant, a very humorous type of bloke, and said there's no way the Germans were going to stop him having a sleep. And furthermore, he did no more, he took all his clothes off except his vest and got down to it, you see. And quite surprisingly, in the middle of the night, we got an order to fire. So he jumped out of bed, laid the gun in his, sitting on the seat on his bare bottom. The gun reared a little bit and landed on his trousers and all his clothes that were down at the side of the wheel. And we had to wait. We had the amusing spectacle of waiting for the next round of gunfire while the gun jumped, and then pulling his trousers and what have you. And the next round of gunfire wasn't for about an hour and a half, and he had to stand there in his nudity, more or less. So, and that was an amusing situation. I remember that.
Would you get food brought up to you while you were in this country?
Oh yes. Oh dear. Oh dear. Yes. Can I go back a little bit and tell you another amusing story?
Fair enough.
When we were in the back position, shall we say, at Alamein, the one that we occupied for 2 or 3 months.
Before the battle.
Before the battle. The order of the day always was that only so many people were allowed at the cookhouse. And then it became, because of the possibility of shelling and bombing, it was one man had to go from the cookhouse to the cookhouse truck at the back and bring back the gun detachment's meal. And on this particular day, don't forget, we were not a long way from Alexandria. We were only 70 miles from Alexandria. And someone, the battery commander, had the foresight to send the quartermaster sergeant down to Alexandria and say, get these blokes a bit of something special. And he had brought back a load of bananas and custard powder. And so this particular day, I took it upon myself to go and fetch the meal. And I was duly given one small Dixie full of stew and another Dixie full of bananas and custard. And halfway back with these things, there was shells came over, so I landed flat on the ground, and in doing so, the bananas and custard went in with the stew. And when I got back to the gun pit, all the lads sort of got stuck into this thick stew, and they said, "My God, this is good, you know." And then one of them said, "What's for afters?" I said, "You've already had them." stew and bananas and custard. Very, very, very tasty in the desert.
But while you were actually up at the... during the bombardment, you get food brought to you there, would you?
No, we had to fetch our own. There again, we always adopted this same system whereby one person went to the cookhouse truck to get the meal. This business of never getting a lot of men together in an exposed position was carried out to the nth degree. Yeah.
What about counter battery fire? Did you have a problem with that during this?
No. I can't remember an awful lot about it, obviously, but I know we did a fair amount of counter-battery firing, obviously. No, I wouldn't be able to specify any counter-battery firing.
So what... I meant on any shells landing on your battery.
Oh, we had quite a few. Oh, yes. I'm sorry, I was thinking of the actual technique of counter-battery firing. Oh, yes, we had... Oh, yes, we had quite a lot of shells at our main. First lot went way over the top, but But certainly the response from the Germans was not as considerable as what we'd been used to. I think the blasting of the... by that time, of course, we got air superiority in the desert as well, which was something we'd never had before. And I think, obviously, Montgomery had decided there's no way we were going to go into battle without air superiority. Yeah.
So what happened next, then?
I got taken out of action. I was told to report to the Remy workshops with my gun to have a fresh barrel put in, because when we looked up the barrel, there was no rifling left in the barrel at all. It was just absolutely shorn off completely, all smooth all the way up.
Could you just explain what effect that would have on your fire?
Yes, we found out afterwards that my shells were dropping about 1,000 yards short.
Would that have caused problems with the infantry?
Yes. There's no doubt about it that, on reflection, that we probably dropped rounds in our own infantry.
You wouldn't get told that?
We wouldn't know. No.